Welcome to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. My email address is bam@Catholicism.org. I can also be found easily on Twitter @Brother_Andre and on Facebook. This evening, I'm very excited about the subject we're going to be speaking of. It will be about St. Ferdinand III, and I'm calling the show St. Ferdinand III, Catholic Spain Personified. And our guest this evening is Dr. Alexandra Wilhelmsen, the professor of Spanish and adjunct professor of history at the University of Dallas. Dr. Wilhelmsen has been with us before when our subject was Spanish Carlism, and that show is actually still archived. You can go to the Reconquest.net show website and look it up. I believe it was episode number 7, but just look up her name and you'll find it. So we're talking about Ferdinand III, the great crusader, great king, monarch of Spain. And because I would like to maximize my time interviewing Dr. Wilhelmsen, who is an expert on Spanish history and who told me that her favorite saint is St. Ferdinand III, which is what led us to do this show, I thought that I would set it up by giving a brief introduction to St. Ferdinand. And the briefest introduction that I thought I could give that also has a certain quality to it is the actual liturgical lesson that the Church gives us in the traditional divine office for the office of Matins, which is the longest of all of the hours of the divine office. And in this one, it's got the life of the saint sort of in a truncated fashion. So here goes the liturgical lesson by Holy Mother Church for the feast of St. Ferdinand III, which, by the way, if you want to look this up, it is May 31st is his feast day, and you can actually, the thing that I'm reading will be linked from reconquest.net. Ferdinand III, King of Castile and León, to whom for now 4 centuries, because this is written some time ago, the title of saint has been given both by clergy and laity, exhibited so much prudence in his youthful years that his mother, Berengaria, Queen of Castile, who had educated him in a very holy manner, resigned her kingdom in his favor. Scarcely had Ferdinand assumed the care of governing than he shone conspicuous in all the virtues becoming a king. Magnanimity, clemency, justice, and above all, zeal for Catholic faith and worship, which he ardently defended and propagated. He mainly showed this zeal by forbidding heretics to settle in his states. He also gave proofs of it by building, endowing, and dedicating to Christian worship churches in Cordova, Jaén, Sevilla, and other cities rescued from the Moorish yoke. He restored with holy and royal munificence the cathedrals of Toledo, Burgos, and other cities. At the same time, he levied powerful armies in the kingdom of Castile and León, which he inherited from his father Alphonsus, and each year gave battle to the Saracens, the enemies of the Christian religion. The great means whereby this most holy king secured victory in every engagement were the prayers he offered up to God. He used also to chastise his body with disciplines and a rough hair shirt, with the intention of rendering God propitious. By so doing, he gained extraordinary victories over the mighty armies of the Moors, and after taking possession of Jaén, Córdoba, and Murcia, and making a tributary of the kingdom of Granada, he restored many cities to the Christian religion and to Spain. He led his victorious standard before Sevilla, the capital of Baeza, being, as it is related, urged thereto by St. Isidore, who had formerly been bishop of that city, and who appeared to him in a vision. Of course, St. Isidore had been dead for several hundred years at that point. Historians also relate that he was miraculously aided during that siege, and in the following manner. The Mohammedans had stretched an iron chain across the Guadalquivir in order to block up the passage. Suddenly, there arose a violent wind, and one of the royal ships was, by the king's order, sent against the chain, which was thus broken, and with so much violence that it was carried far beyond and bore down a bridge of boats. The Moors, lost all their hope, and the city surrendered. Ferdinand attributed all these victories to the patronage of the Blessed Virgin Mary, whose image he always had in his camp and honored it with so much devotion. Having taken Sevilla, his first thoughts were directed to religion. He immediately caused the Mosque of the Saracens to be purified and dedicated as a Christian church, having with a princely and pious munificence provided it with an archiepiscopal see, richly endowed, as also a well-appointed college of canons and dignitaries. Canons, of course, being clergy, religious clergy who said the divine office, sang the divine office, and said mass in the cathedral. He, moreover, built several other churches and monasteries in the same city. Whilst engaged in these holy works, he was making preparations to pass over to Africa, there to crush the Mohammedan Empire. See, he wanted to get rid of them at the source, so to speak. But he was called to the kingdom of heaven. When his last hour came, he fastened a cord around his neck, prostrated on the ground, and shedding abundant tears, adored the Blessed Sacrament, which was brought to him as viaticum. Having received it in admirable dispositions of reverence, humility, and faith, he slept in the Lord. His body, which has remained incorrupt for 6 centuries, is buried in a tomb of extraordinary richness in the Cathedral of Seville. I'm pronouncing it, I think, right correctly in Spanish. It's Seville. So there's the church's liturgical lesson. Saint Ferdinand was the cousin of Saint Louis, the King of France, because his mother, Blanche of Castile, was Berengaria, was the sister of Blanche of Castile, who was Saint Louis the Ninth's mother. So they were first cousins by their mothers, both of whom were Spanish. All right, so I think we've given a good introduction to this great king and martyr, who is also a confessor of the Catholic faith and a crusader. So definitely not a politically correct saint. And now I'd like to bring Dr. Wilhelmsen in, and we'll start to interview her about this great saint who happens to be her favorite. Good evening, Dr. Wilhelmsen.
Hello, Brother André Marie.
How are you doing this evening?
Well, delighted to be with you.
Good, very good, very good. And you're enjoying your summer now that you're not in the classroom anymore?
Yes, indeed. But let me tell you, it's 97 degrees here.
Oh, okay. So it's hot in Dallas, huh?
Yes.
Oh, goodness. Well,
it is hot.
Then I won't tell you how pleasantly cool it is here in New Hampshire.
I can just imagine that.
Well, Doctor, when last we spoke in January, when we were talking about the Carlists, you did mention to me, as I said, that St. Ferdinand III is your favorite saint, and that is how we got the idea for having this show. Why don't we begin by having you tell us why he is your favorite saint?
Well, he was successful at everything he tried to do. He was successful as a son, as a husband, as a father. He was successful as a ruler. He was successful as a warrior. He obviously was successful as a good and holy man. There are many great heroes in Spanish history, and there are also many great saints. But I think San Fernando, as he's called in Spain, was the one who united all of those things.
Uh-huh. So he was a success. So he's sort of the patron saint of Donald Trump, huh?
Kind of.
just kidding. Okay.
Except that Donald Trump is not a great exemplar, of holiness.
No, not a great saint.
And Christian values. But, I mean, he was super successful at everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Donald Trump would admire him if he knew about it.
Yeah, well, he made Spain great again.
Right.
Okay, so now we have a sort of a thumbnail of why he is your favorite saint. His title was King of Castile and León.
Yes.
Now, I would imagine that a good number of our listeners have been taught that modern Spain, at least in its geographical expanse as we know it now, dates back to 1469 when Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabel of Castile were married and united those two kingdoms. How much, but in medieval Spain, we're talking about smaller kingdoms, several smaller kingdoms. How much
Indeed.
Of current-day Spain did Ferdinand actually rule some 230 years previous to Ferdinand and Isabella?
Probably close to two-thirds.
Okay, so two-thirds of modern-day Spain. Mm-hmm.
So okay. When Isabel married Ferdinand in the 15th century, she inherited, after a few years, the crown of Castile. By then, Castile included León.
Okay.
So León and Castile were united for the last time when St. Ferdinand ruled them. From then on, it was just one kingdom, and gradually the term León disappeared, and it was just known as the Kingdom of Castile.
Okay, because if you read his years, the years that he ruled, he was King of Castile from, I think, 1217, and then King of León from, I think, 1231.
Exactly.
So he got these kingdoms in succession.
Yes.
So these are very complex lines mm-hmm. of succession, right?
The Castilian inheritance came through his mother, and the Leonese, we say in Spanish, came through his father.
Okay.
And so he was a teenager when he became King of Castile, but he was about 30 when he became King of León. And as I said, those two were united, and from then on, known more commonly just as the Kingdom of Castile.
So when we call Isabella of Castile, that is because she was the queen of that now expanded Castile, which is Castile.
Exactly. Okay. So that when she married Ferdinand of Aragon, she was the heiress to a much larger part of the Iberian Peninsula than he was.
Okay.
As King of Aragon.
Now I'm going to have a picture posted on a painting posted on reconquest.net that I found that's in the public domain, so I won't get sued. That has a picture of Ferdinand III holding his sword Lobera, which he's wearing this glorious cloak. Which, if you look
that's
at
probably
it closely,
the picture by Murillo.
Actually, this one is by an anonymous painter, and it's hanging up in the town hall of Seville. But the cloak that he's wearing has the coat of arms both of Castile and León. So it's like alternating patterns of those two. Coats of arms.
Well, in the city of Seville, every year on the anniversary of his reconquest, or of his entering the city, reconquering it from the Muslims, the cathedral brings out a banner that he had when he entered the city, and it had Castile and León on it.
Nice. You're listening to Reconquest.
And the castles and the lion to represent the two kingdoms.
Okay. Let me just do an identification here. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie, your host. I'm interviewing Dr. Alexander Wilhelmsen, and we're talking about St. Ferdinand III, the personification of Catholic Spain. Now, Dom Prosper Guéranger, in his great magisterial work, The Année Liturgique, The Liturgical Year, has this to say about our subject, quote, Catholic Spain is personified in her Ferdinand. And of course, this quote kind of inspired the title that I gave the show. What would your comments on that statement be?
Well, Ferdinand is the only king of any Spanish kingdom who is a canonized saint. And for hundreds of years, first the crown of Castile and later on the crown of all of Spain was known as, the throne, which is essentially the same thing, the throne of St. Ferdinand. So St. Ferdinand, in that sense, became the emblem of Spain. Now, of course, Spain also has, Our Lady of the Pillar as patroness, and St. Teresa of Avila as patron, co-patroness, and St. James, he has lots of patrons. But St. Ferdinand was identified with the monarchy, with the crown, with the state. mm-hmm. and a Catholic state, of course.
And of course, Spain was known for most of its history not as Spain, right? It was, wasn't it? Right. Didn't they call it La Monarquía Católica? Is that it?
They certainly did during the Golden Age, during the Age of Expansion, in the Renaissance, the Baroque Age. The Spaniards didn't know what to call their huge empire, and they called it La Monarquía Católica.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the Catholic monarchy. Well, right. There you go. So.
Well, now that we're being technical, let me say something. St. Ferdinand was Ferdinand III, King of Castile. He was not St. Ferdinand III, because that would imply that there were two previous kings of Castile who were named Ferdinand who were saints.
Okay.
So
okay.
The Spaniards, in order to clarify, tend to call him Ferdinand III, the saint. Well, when you say Ferdinand III, the saint, it sounds like the saint is a nickname.
Okay. But it what, wasn't,
but
get, it was kind of...
What they're trying to do is get around calling him St. Ferdinand III, as I said, because that would imply two previous canonized Ferdinands who were kings.
Oh, okay. Okay. So he's not the third saint. He's not the third saint. He's the third
yeah.
king.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, same thing for any king or pope, for that matter. I mean, doesn't mean that they're all saints. And
right.
Okay. So I thought you were going to tell me that he was the third of Castile, but not the third of Leon or something, like, because sometimes that happens. Like that,
yeah,
with,
that can get very complicated, especially with medieval rulers.
Yeah, and even with Emperor Charles.
Yes, Emperor Charles V, for sure.
Yeah, but I mean Charles of Austria. He was the... he had two different numbers depending upon whether it was of Hungary or the Empire, right?
Oh, no doubt. Well, in the great Renaissance Emperor Charles V was Charles the first in Castile and in various Spanish kingdoms. He was known as Carlos I. Well, some people called him Carlos V, and some called him Carlos I. Mm-hmm. You know,
but as Emperor, he was the fifth.
As Emperor, he was the fifth, right?
Okay. All right, so we know why he's your favorite. We know you agree with Dom Guéranger's estimate that he's somehow personified Catholic Spain.
Sure, of course.
Now, okay, so as I said too earlier, that his mother Berengaria and Blanche of Castile were sisters, and therefore their offspring, respectively, Ferdinand III and Louis IX. Were cousins. Now, I've read them contrasted as Louis IX had this life that was full of crosses and afflictions, and he somehow embodied the cross. Whereas, as you said, Ferdinand III, the patron of Donald Trump, was a success. he was successful at everything he did. Sort of had the Midas touch. Aside from that contrast, how would you contrast the two?
Well, Ferdinand was a great success, but that doesn't mean he didn't have crosses and mm-hmm. suffering. Mm-hmm. After all, he was very happily married to a German princess, and they had many children, and she died, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And then eventually he remarried. But losing a beloved wife was no doubt a very, very sad thing, a cross, you know. Mm-hmm. But... St. Ferdinand, as I said, was what they had in common, of course, is that they were rulers, and they were saints, and they were crusaders. They had a lot of things in common.
But
St. Ferdinand was more successful in many of his endeavors.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, I mean, St. Louis, you know, of course, was fighting losing crusades and was imprisoned by the Muslims.
Yeah.
And then, of course, died, you know, of a plague while he was in someplace in North Africa, right?
Yes. Well, let me say something about this, the contrast of the crusades. I read many, many years ago that that St. Louis wrote to his cousin and invited him and suggested, urged him to go with him on one of those two crusades to North Africa. And that Ferdinand answered, "There's no lack of Muslims in my own country."
Uh-huh. And, you know,
and
that was
unfocused. And also one of the popes at the time, appeal, I don't remember who now, because it's been a long time since I read this, but one of the popes at the time, realizing that St. Ferdinand, you know, was an awesome warlord, asked for his help in the eternal Italian problems, politics, and the king wrote him back wishing him the best of luck and said no. He focused on what he had decided was his job, which was Spain.
There were popes that actually forbade Spaniards or did all sorts of things to discourage them to go from going to the Holy Land because they knew that
they wanted them to keep, yes, over and over again, different popes at different times when Spanish kings were squabbling among themselves. The popes would write and say, come on, folks, it's time that you have another campaign into Al-Andalus.
Yeah.
Make the peace among yourselves. And that occurred with Ferdinand's grandfather, who was able to make the peace among a lot of the different little Christian rulers in Spain and led them on a campaign and won one of the greatest battles of the whole medieval reconquist in 1212.
That's Las Navas del Tolosa, right?
Exactly. And that was at the bidding of one of the popes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was a Herculean effort to get all those kings to put aside their petty squabbles and come together. Now, Saint, I tell you what, Doctor, why don't we just hold that thought, and we're going to go to a break right now, and we'll come back for the next segment, okay? You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be.
You're listening to Reconquest with Brother Andre Marie, seeking that which was lost and fighting for it, exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Welcome back to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. You can email me if you have any questions or suggestions about the show. My email address is bam@catholicism.org. I'm on Twitter @brother_Andre, and I'm also easily found on Facebook. By the way, I kind of hate social media, but I stay on it because people contact me about important things, so that's why I do it. Sometimes I'm embarrassed to announce all this stuff, but it definitely has its value. Dr. Wilhelmsen, I have a question for you that I think, just very briefly, we need to let the audience know that when we talk about St. Louis as a crusader who went to the Holy Land and fought in the Crusades, what's commonly called the Crusades, and we talk about his cousin, St. Ferdinand III, being a crusader, we're not being analogical there. We're not making a metaphor. They were both crusaders in the strict sense, right?
Yes, absolutely. This is to say, a crusade was a war in which two of the main purposes were religious. And so they combined, you might say, spiritual and religious things and material things. Mm-hmm. That was number one. And number two, they were called or at least sanctioned by the papacy, and the men who fought, as long as they were not doing terrible things, were given special spiritual privileges. And by the same token, the kings and local authorities were supposed to respect and protect their families while they were gone. So those were some of the characteristics, as far as I understand it, of the technicalities of what actually was a crusade.
Okay, very good. Now, I mentioned earlier when I was reading from the liturgical lesson of Ferdinand III's life that he wanted to go to Africa. After he successfully conquered, I think it was Seville, Dom Guéranger says this. He says, the Moors foresaw that the result would be their total expulsion from the peninsula. But this was not all that Ferdinand aimed at. He even intended to invade Africa and thus crush the Muslim power forever. Muslim, of course, being an old-fashioned word based upon Muslimin, which is what they call themselves. So I would suppose it's one of history's great what-ifs. Sort of like what would have happened if the South would have won the war or something like that. But what do you think that had he lived, he could have stamped out Islamic hegemony in Africa and thereby spared us a lot of our modern day problems?
No.
You don't? Okay.
No, he could have carved out a couple of little towns. You know, he could have taken some towns on the coast of North Africa, towns from which the Spaniards, the Christians, could help control the strait that separates the Mediterranean and the Atlantic and North Africa and Europe. But the Muslim lands in North Africa were huge, huge. Mm-hmm. And then the number, the armies that went from North Africa to Spain were huge compared to the European armies of the time. Mm-hmm. I don't think he would have gotten too far, other than perhaps a few towns right on the coast.
And, of course, they could have always mustered up more Muslim resources from the elsewhere in the Maghreb and even the
exactly.
Arabian Peninsula.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, when you think of how big the Maghreb is and how large those armies of Almoravids and Almohads and the Marinids a little bit later after Ferdinand's time were, they were so much larger than the Christian European armies. Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, has always been underpopulated compared to most of Europe. So I don't think he would have gotten too far. But by the way, it's my understanding, although I'm not an expert on this, but it's my understanding that he did manage to get, I mean, he was powerful in the Iberian Peninsula, and he obviously had never lost a battle. So he had a lot of moral authority, and people feared him. People in Africa feared him. And so somehow, apparently, he managed to negotiate so that a couple of Christian churches were built in North Africa in what today is Morocco.
Wow.
I think they were built by the new Franciscan. He's considered a Franciscan tertiary, one of the first. And so I think these were Franciscan churches.
Okay. All right. Well, wow, that's very interesting that he actually had that kind of firepower at the negotiating table, which I guess is related to his firepower on the field, huh?
Probably so.
So the going from his say his foreign policy, really his war policy. What can we say about his domestic policies? In other words, how was he as a ruler of Christian Castile and León?
Well, he was a very good ruler. He kept the peace with all of his neighbors, which was very difficult to do in the Iberian Peninsula in the Middle Ages. And when he signed a treaty, or he inherited a treaty from previous rulers that hadn't expired yet, he followed it to the T. The man was so famous for always keeping his word, always doing what he had signed, what he had said he was going to do, what he was committed to do. So he kept the peace among with his co-rulers of other parts of Spain. He kept the peace within his realms. He was tough when he was young, as a teenager. When he came to the throne, there had been chaos before, and for a few years, and naturally the other warlords and great magnates of the time wanted to take advantage of having a young teenage boy on the throne, and he put them in their place very quickly. And from then on, there was no problem. There was peace in his lands, which the people must have greatly appreciated. Also, he was constantly on horseback, going from one place to the next, to settle affairs, to hold court, and some of the documents exist from the decisions that he made as a judge. Apparently, he was tough and he was fair. And so these are things that he did. And then when he reconquered lands, he made a lot of efforts to see to it that the division of lands that had been abandoned by the Muslims was fair. He set up committees, and he oversaw those committees in Seville and Cordoba to make sure that land and empty houses were distributed fairly. He protected the Muslims and Jews who did live in his lands, and he was constantly sending food. You know, when there was famine or almost famine here or there, you know, we hear of hundreds of mules with packs of food being sent. And he, you know, he managed to find supplies and send them here, there, and yonder constantly.
So there's that virtue of munificence that was mentioned in the lesson, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now he also... as you mentioned, was a member, as a Third Order member, he was a member of the new Franciscan movement, as was his cousin, Louis the Ninth.
Mm-hmm.
Now he favored the friars. Of course, there are the Franciscans and the Dominicans and the Mercedarians and the Trinitarians and Carmelites, mm-hmm. and all these other mendicant orders, which were very different. Especially then, they were notably different in their mobility and their mission work and so forth from the Benedictine or Carthusian
monks.
Now, so the friars and the monks were quite different. Isn't it true that he installed in the cities that he conquered from the Muslims, he brought in these new orders and set them
up? Yes. Now, he restored four bishoprics. So he got the, you know, these bishoprics had pretty much disappeared under hundreds and hundreds of years of Muslim domination. And so new bishops were set up and cathedrals were built, or the main mosque, as in the case of Seville, was turned into a church. So he set up the bishoprics, and then it was, okay, we got to build churches for parishes. And I think he may have given money to some. Well, I know he gave money to help build some monasteries in the old part of Castile and León. But the Reconquest had three aspects always. One was military. One was social, the resettlement of these lands. So we can talk about colonists moving from northern Spain down to the south. And the third was re-evangelization. Mm-hmm. And I think he felt that the friars would be very good in preaching the gospel, in the re-evangelization of areas that had been under Islam for so long, and there was only a remnant of Christianity left.
Yeah, so we think of these places, oh, he's reconquering Spain, but it wasn't so much Spain as much as it was Al-Andalus when they moved in, right? I mean,
and you know, when you think of his greatest reconquest, which was the city of Seville, and this was the first. Seville is on the Guadalquivir River, and in those days, since the ships were very small, the river was navigable from the coast all the way up to Seville.
Mm.
And he organized the first navy that was run by the king, that was not a private enterprise or merchant marine. And so just imagine, he had Basques from northern Spain and sail all along the coast of northern Spain, down the course of Portugal, and then up the river Guadalquivir. Well, I've always imagined, and I tell my students, just imagine the Muslim peoples living on both sides of the river. When they saw this flotilla of Christian ships with banners, and, you know, Spaniards being Spaniards, they got images of the Blessed Virgin on their sails and the crosses on their sails and this, that, and the other. How would those people have felt when their ancestors had been there for 500 years?
Yeah, yeah.
Their Muslim ancestors had been there, and they were Muslim for 500 years.
Yeah, it would be...
To them, this was their homeland.
It might be like now, the Hurons taking New York back.
Right. So, you know, when I grew up in Spain, our textbooks talked about the Muslims as though they were foreigners. But they were only foreigners. Only the invaders were foreigners. Mm-hmm. The others were born there.
Yeah. Yeah, literally they were native because they were born there.
And they
right?
were his. Yeah. Yeah, they were Hispano-Arabs.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was a lot. I mean, we tend to think of the Muslims as the bad guys, and, of course, they were relative to the faith. But there was a tremendous amount of cultural I hesitate to say enrichment, but really it was. I mean, architecture and music and so forth that was influenced by Arab and Eastern arts came into Spain, right, and gave Spain some of its distinctive features.
Well, over the centuries, the Hispanic peoples who converted to Islam, and then, you know, generations later, here they are, those people whose ancestors had always been there, and who inherited some bits and pieces of Roman tradition and this and that, they developed, they incorporated some of the things that the Arabs had taken to Spain, and they created Hispano-Moorish art, which is very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And also, I have to say this is important, Ferdinand III and another king, a king of Aragon, James I, between the two of them, they reconquered more land than all the previous Christian kings in 500 years.
Oh.
And as you know, they just left a little remnant of the kingdom of Granada. What did that mean? That meant that the next generation in the second half of the 13th century was the first generation in 500 years that did not have to put almost all of its efforts into survival. They didn't have to stand watches. They didn't have to build lookout towers. They didn't have to constantly be training and drilling in militias.
Mm-hmm.
Because Al-Andalus was reduced to the Kingdom of Granada. And then we have this huge cultural flourishing. Alphonse X the Wise, Ferdinand's son, was the great promoter of culture and the greatest one in the entire 1,000 years of the Middle Ages.
So this gives us the Siglo de Oro, the Golden Age.
Then this is going to lead, obviously, to the Siglo de Oro, right? But during that great flourishing of the second half of the 13th century, there was influence from Al-Andalus, there was Jewish influence, and lots of Christian things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Even, Spanish architecture is beautiful because of this. You can see a lot of sort of Arabic features in some of the church mm-hmm. architecture. All right, mm-hmm. So what would you say? You mentioned the banners of Our Lady. That reminds me of another question that
uh-huh.
I had. Dom Guérin-Jay speaks very poetically of St. Ferdinand's Marian piety. What can you tell us about his devotion to Our Lady?
Oh, it was spectacular. My heavens. When he went on campaign, and he went on campaign for 28 years, never losing a battle, he would stay up all night, the night before, praying in front of a statue of Our Lady. And the first few times, apparently, some of his soldiers said, "Well, sir, if you don't get any sleep, how are you going to lead us tomorrow?" And he said, "Well, I don't think you're praying, so therefore I have to pray." But the story is that he had three statues he took on campaign, and he set up a little tent for each one. Three statues of Our Lady. Well, only one of those big statues has come down to history. It was a gift from his second wife, and it's the one that is in the Cathedral of Seville. It's known as the Our Lady of the Reyes, which in Spanish means the monarchs. And it's brought out in procession once or twice a year. And it shows the Blessed Virgin seated with the baby Jesus in her lap. So that's one. And then, of course, he is known for having a little, tiny, maybe 8 inches, ivory statue of Our Lady and the baby Jesus that he hooked to his saddle. And that is also still exists. It's in the cathedral in Seville.
Hmm. So this is a very, obviously, a fervent devotion that he had to Our Lady. And the Spanish devotion to Our Lady is epic. I mean, in the whole history of the Reconquista, it is very Marian from its beginnings back in the Covadonga, which the word itself, doesn't it have a sort of a corruption of the Latin word for Dominica, Our Lady?
Yeah, the cave of Cova Dominica or something similar to that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, also, of course, in the 13th century, there was an outburst of Marian devotion all over Europe. And so St. Ferdinand passed this on to his son. Think about it. His son, the next king, Alphonse X the Wise, co-authored one of the greatest books of poetry dedicated to Our Lady in the entire Middle Ages.
Hmm. Well, that's beautiful. I mean, what was the name of the book?
Las Cantigas de Santa María.
Now, haven't those been set to music?
Yes, they have. And you can go right to the YouTube and find all kinds of bits and pieces of the Cantigas.
Okay.
Because this manuscript is fantastic. It's a series of many, many poems, cantigas or cantigas, some people say nowadays. They were meant to be sung, and so they're musical scores. And the music was Hispano-Arabic music.
Okay. Okay.
Not Gregorian chant or something more Western. And then the king hired the best manuscript illuminators to illustrate the manuscript. And so it's a combination of poetry, music, art, and the poems all have something to do with the Blessed Virgin. And in the book, the king says, I want to be a troubadour of Our Lady.
Wow, that's beautiful. Of course, the troubadours being the traveling musicians from France, right?
So, obviously, his father, inspired him in that devotion. But as I said, that devotion was very important at that time in history, late 12th and 13th century.
Mm. Yeah, and
you know that probably better than I do.
And all of the mendicant movement. I mean, this was principally spread through the mendicant movements, right? The mendicant orders, which were very Marian in their pious. Saint Dominic, of course, who was a Spaniard, founder of the Dominicans.
I've always wondered. I found it curious that Saint Francis, who was King of Castile, did not favor the Dominicans over the Franciscans.
Yeah, because of the Spanish connection, right?
The Dominicans were founded by a Castilian, mm-hmm. whereas the Franciscans were, as we know, founded by an Italian from Assisi. But, he loved all of the mendicant orders, but he favored the Franciscan.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple more questions for you, but I tell you what, I think what we're going to do is we're going to go to break now so that the third segment will have some meat to it and won't be just a short little coda as it usually is, because I want to keep talking to you a little bit more, Doctor. So please stick around. You listen to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be.
Your guide to the reconquest of what modern man has lost. Think of it as a roadmap to truth with a crucifix as a compass. Reconquest is exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.
Welcome back to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of the Veritas Radio Network. This is Brother Andre Marie coming to you from St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Our websites are Catholicism.org and Reconquest.net. We're interviewing Dr. Alexandra Wilhelmsen, a Spanish scholar, a professor of Spanish and adjunct professor of history at the University of Dallas in Dallas, Texas. And we're talking about St. Ferdinand III, the personification of Catholic Spain. So we only have a little over 8 minutes, Doctor, and I wanted to ask you a couple of more questions. First of all, what lessons do you think that St. Ferdinand III offers to statesmen today? We are in an election year, and maybe our candidates might want to read up on how to be a good statesman. What lessons could they learn from Ferdinand III?
Well, I don't know if I can give lessons per se, but he certainly dealt with some of the same topics that they're dealing with today, and maybe close study of his biography would elicit the lessons. But here are some of the things that he dealt with. Military budgets. What should the relationship be between victors and vanquished? How does one treat prisoners of war? How does one treat political refugees? how does one deal with border tensions without building walls, I guess, okay? But then he did build walls around cities.
Yeah.
And diverse population. Now, this is interesting. When he and James I over in Aragon conquered so many lands, the Muslims could not evacuate all those lands. In the previous time, in the Reconquest, with the exception of El Cid's short period in Valencia, when the Christians reconquered an area, most of the Muslims chose to leave, and they would move farther south to be with their co-religionists and to continue living their lifestyle. Some would stay. There was always a Muslim neighborhood in just about every town. But the most would leave. But in Ferdinand's time, since he conquered so much, and James the First conquered a lot over in Aragon, not nearly as much as Ferdinand, but he conquered a lot, there was limited space. I mean, only the little kingdom of Granada was left. So St. Ferdinand and James the First were the first rulers who had to rule over a diverse population. Different ethnic groups, not just a small minority of Jews, different ethnic groups, different religions, different languages. And they managed, particularly Ferdinand managed well.
So he was the same chivalry that he showed on the field, he showed also when he governed.
Apparently so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was tough, but he was always fair. From what I can tell.
Mm-hmm. And this wasn't a modern concept of religious liberty, but it was a concept of tolerating people who were, after all, in his realms and they were his subjects.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And the relationship between the Jewish community and the Christian kings in the peninsula in the Middle Ages tended to be, from what I understand from a legal point of view, tended to be that the rulers protected the Jews, that mm-hmm. the Jews were there under a special protection of the rulers. Now, they might or might not have liked that, but apparently, I mean, I'm thinking of the life of Queen Isabel mm-hmm. in the 15th century. That's definitely how she saw the relationship, and that was an inherited idea. And of course, later on, as we know, she changed things. But that apparently was the idea.
Mm-hmm. And she had reason too, right? I mean,
yeah, that's another story.
Yeah, I know it's another story.
But. Right.
It wasn't just some sort of flight of fancy, which said, I think I'll kick the Jews out today.
Nothing flighty about Queen Isabel.
No. maybe we'll do that in another show.
Maybe so, yeah.
There's one more question I have for you in the roughly 4 minutes we have left. Saint Ferdinand III had some family dysfunctionality about him. And when you and I were speaking some months ago, back in January, I made the remark that maybe we can say he's the patron saint of dysfunctional families, and God knows we've got lots of those around. What do you have to say to that?
Well, first of all, I think it's a great phrase. Patron saint of dysfunctional families is exactly what lots of people could call him. He was born into a family that produced saints. But also all kinds of problems. First of all, there were a number of kingdoms, as we've been saying, in the Christian kingdoms in the Iberian Peninsula. Well, of course, rulers and the royals were supposed to marry other royals, and there weren't that many. And so they were all intimately related. Well, his father, Alphonse IX of Leon, and his mother were married with permission from various local bishops. But when the Pope found out, he said, no, this is a case of consanguinity. They're too closely related, and annulled the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually the father tried again. Same thing happened with his second wife. Well, after he had had two happy marriages disrupted by Rome on account of consanguinity, the man took a mistress. So now, here's Ferdinand. He's the son of the second marriage. So he has a stepmother, who was a Portuguese princess and a saint, Teresa of Portugal. And he has full brothers and sisters, half brothers and sisters, step brothers and sisters. Legitimate brother. His parents' family marriage was annulled. That was a problem because he couldn't inherit a throne as a quote-unquote illegitimate son. That was a big problem.
Yeah.
And he managed to get along with everybody. They had custody fights. They had all the things that we think of today, and all of it combined with political problems, because the family, all these different families were ruling families.
So it, obviously,
and Saint Ferdinand managed to get along with everybody.
And all of these bring up questions of succession too. So these things would have had to be banged out with lawyers and such.
Yes, and his mother, known in English as Berengaria and Berenguela in Spanish, was a fantastic woman, and you know, she was married to Alphonse IX of Leon. His first wife, the one who is Saint Teresa of Portugal, was a wonderful woman. And those two women, who obviously at one time or another loved the same man, but otherwise probably considered themselves rivals and their children rivals, those two women got together and figured out what to do. But then, the magnates of the realms had to be brought around. So in the midst of all this family chaos, Saint Ferdinand got along with everybody.
And it wasn't just because he was he was spineless and just everybody what they wanted. Obviously, this is a man of tremendous fortitude.
He was charitable, he was diplomatic, he was considerate, from what I can tell.
And he must have had a hefty dose of the cardinal virtue of prudence.
Obviously so. Yeah. And didn't you read something about prudence in the Divine Office?
Yeah, that was
one of the word prudence mentioned? Yes,
I think
so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Doctor, thank you very much. We're out of time now, but I'm really grateful for you spending the time and telling us all about St. Ferdinand III. Maybe we can come back and you can talk about something else having to do with Spain. Like maybe we can talk about how Spain isn't as bad as everyone says it is, the Black Legend, which is still with us.
I love to defend Spain.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor. You're listening to Reconquest on the Crusade Channel of Veritas Radio Network, radio the way it should be. God bless and Mary keep you.